Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome back to the GeoMob Podcast. With me today is Stephen Ramage. I'm sure that many of you, especially if you've been around geo for the last decade or so, have heard of Stephen. Today, we're going to catch up with what Stephen's currently up to and what he thinks is important in the sector, as well as going over some of the things he's done in the past. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. There's just looking at the show notes, and obviously from knowing you a little bit personally as well, I know that there is an absolute ton of stuff that we could talk about, and we only have about 30 minutes or so. But maybe despite the fact that you have a very, very full CV, you could just give a quick introduction to who Stephen Ramage is and sort of some of the key highlights.
Yeah, sure, sure. So back in 2007, 2008, I was interviewed on another podcast and I described myself as an accidental geographer because I stumbled into the location sector in the early 90s and nothing really changed. So I worked for Oceanics, which was bought by Fugro in the offshore environmental monitoring and marine survey arena. They put me on courses in seismic survey. I learned a bit about geodesy, differential GPS correction receivers, etc., etc. And I think that initial grounding and also having the word GPS on my CV proved instrumental when I went on to work for Navtech, which is now here, HERE.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, yeah.
I was selling Navtech data to LaserScan, which is now OneSpatial, around the sort of late 90s, 2000, when the MD of LaserScan, Mike Sanderson, invited me to join them as a product manager. I became a director pretty quickly, and I was part of the management buyout team in 2003. So, I mean, it's crazy. It's like over 20 years ago.
Yeah,
I was part of the lunch meeting that actually changed the company name to OneSpatial. So it's great to see them still going strong today. Then in 2009, I left to join the OGC, which I always think sounds like some kind of Star Trek organization, the Open Geospatial Consortium, as exec director. And I learned quite a lot about Open Geospatial standards. I even read the GML spec. Then I was invited to join Ordnance Survey to set up their international business in 2012, which I believe is also still going, but in a different structure. So I had a short stint on the board of What Three Words in London, and then I did some consulting work for the UN and the World Bank. Then I joined in 2016, I joined GEO, the Group on Earth Observations, which is housed by the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, in Geneva. And from 2016 to 2023, in GEO, I ended up as the Chief Engagement Officer, working a lot with UN member states, UN, other UN agencies similar to WMO, and the private sector. And then in 2023, I set up my own consulting firm, Rezo Consulting, and I've been advising numerous SMEs and international organisations, as well as successfully winning a contract with ESA and EUMETSAT to be the Executive Officer of the Committee on Earth Observation Satellites, COS. And the CEO team includes Lefteris Mamis from Evenflow and Irene Drakopoulou. So I've got to give them credit for the help they've given me in this first year we've just completed, well, in a couple of weeks. And I guess to round off the last 30 years, I was awarded an honorary degree last month by my alma mater in Glasgow as a doctor of science. So that's kind of it all like squashed together.
So many things. Yeah, well, first off, congratulations for the honorary degree. You must be really chuffed with that.
Thank you. Yes.
I think going back in order, so my questions are, when you were working for GEO, were you living in Geneva? Was that a stint of living abroad in order to do your work? Or were you just traveling lots? Or
No. I mean, I've lived in about 12 countries.
Okay.
But always been paid to live there, which is good. I lived in Geneva when I moved there in 2016. And then I realized how bonkers expensive it is. And I fled across the border, moved into France. And so my son went to school in Geneva, but I only went in for work. And it was good because I could get the bus, you know, right up till COVID. And then I got an electric bike and I was cycling in a lot. But it's kind of mental because now I'm back in Scotland. I fear for my life whenever I go out on a bike. So, yes. I kind of miss Geneva from that perspective, but I don't miss the prices.
Yeah. No, I was talking to someone recently, over the summer, and they were saying how they've got this really snazzy bike that they bought during COVID and lockdown, but ever since all the traffic's come back and the potholes in the road, and they're just not going out on it. So, yeah. The other thing that caught my ear was that you read the GML spec, so congratulations on that as well. There can't be many people who've gone right the way through that. But the really interesting one was when you said that you're an accidental geographer and you just sort of stumbled into work that was actually all about marine survey and seismic survey and geodesy. I mean, those are pretty hardcore, intense things to stumble into. So, was it an instant sort of interest in it, or was it a case of just you needed a job and here's a bunch of training?
I'd got this. I'd sort of won a competition after I graduated, and I did, I guess, what would be the equivalent of computer science today. And when I went to Singapore. I worked for the National Shipping Line of Singapore, and I was out there for a while. And then they posted me to New York and then California and then back to London. And then at the end of all the training, they were like, right, here's your final posting. And they posted me to Felixstowe. And I was like, what? Singapore, New York, California, Felixstowe? You know, I was kind of hoping for somewhere maybe a wee bit more exotic. So I lasted about 6 months in Felixstowe. And then someone who was like an old friend of my sister's, he was like an early high flyer in IT. And he'd said, look, I've got a job in the offshore sector. You know, your kind of generic skills would be quite useful, and you can come and learn about all this offshore survey stuff. And so I went from the dizzy heights of Felixstowe to Great Yarmouth. And it was like, oh man, I don't know which is worse, you know. But, so I ended up Great Yarmouth for a couple of years, and I got all this training, and I did a lot of work with, like, all the oceanics team. And it was funny because Neil Aykroyd, who was the COO at Ordnance Survey for many years, he was at Rakal, I think, at the time. So he was like a competitor living literally like a few doors down from where I was living. You know, he knew the guy who was building the comparative system at Oceanics. So, I just found it super interesting. You know, we were working a lot on remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, and differential GPS corrections receivers. I remember the marketing was the world's smallest Inmarsat differential GPS corrections receiver. And this thing, it was small compared to the ones that were on the ships, but, I mean, you could just about carry it if you'd been working out at the gym for a year. And, you know, you could, like, walk, you know, with two hands on it. And I shared a flat with a guy called Paul Hansen, who's gone on to be some kind of GPS guru. But Paul would, like, spend nights regaling things about geodesy to me, you know. So I had no choice but to learn.
No, indeed. I must admit, I've not been in touch with anyone from Fugro for a number of years now. But I remember, Fugro was really pushing the boundaries back in the sort of early days. I think it was just after I'd done my degree, for some reason there was an open day at the Fugro. I don't know. It was like, it wasn't headquarters, but it was like their command center, which is just outside Wallingford, I think. And that was amazing. I remember, like, in my early 20s, walking into this room, and there were literally banks and banks of screens all around the place. It was like NASA, but with images of where boats were on the Caspian Sea and everywhere. It was just insane to be in this little place outside Wallingford. It was
one of our associates, which we'll talk about later, Pooja Mahapatra. She's actually quite senior in the geospatial and climate side of things at Fugro. And I was just looking up out of interest, you know, when we started chatting to each other. And there's something like 11,000 people at Fugro. Wow. So it's enormous. I mean, I always knew them as a kind of a geotechnical firm, but they've obviously branched into a lot more areas. But they're still very true to the kind of marine sector.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well, there, as we've already found out, there are so many things that we could talk about, but perhaps we can talk a little bit more about Geobon. So maybe you could introduce what the network is and why it exists, how it exists, and what your role was when you were there.
Yeah, so Geobon is one of those geo from the Group on Earth Observations. It's one of those main activities that's been around for over a decade, and I'm currently on the Geobon Advisory Board. When I came across it, it kind of blew me away that it's a global biodiversity observations network, and it was just the scale of it that kind of really intrigued me. I checked with them recently and they told me there's now 3,400 registered members. So those are scientists, researchers and other stakeholders from almost 150 countries.
That's amazing.
So it is. And the way they kind of like sort of like drive the community and steer the community from the Secretariat is something that is quite impressive as well. So through the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, the CBD, there's a something called the Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework, the KMGBF, and that talks about the urgent need to conserve and restore biodiversity, and it has a monitoring framework that parties, i.e. the countries, to the CBD have adopted. So it includes a lot of agreed-upon indicators to use and monitor and report on progress towards the goals and targets that they have. And Geobon focuses on addressing the sort of critical lack of global infrastructure for biodiversity monitoring, especially for more sort of collaborative and coordinated monitoring efforts. So as well as strengthening national capacity to monitor biodiversity, they've also addressed the gap by creating a sort of a biodiversity observation network to provide up-to-date, reliable, and I guess what the term is normally actionable data.
Sorry to interrupt, but so is that only from Earth observation data, or is that biodiversity indicators from in situ as well? Are they trying to? Oh,
absolutely. Okay. It's across the board. And you know, I learned some stuff about. I went to their plenary last year, and I learned some stuff about sort of bioacoustics and eDNA and all these other methods that are being used. So it's very broad, but one of the main things that they've focused on is essential biodiversity variables. So you might have come across essential climate variables that are very well embedded in the sort of UNFCCC arena, and so they've been working on this. They have a platform called Bon in a Box, which is a biodiversity observation network in a box where you can get access to code and data and all sorts of things. So it makes it much easier to work with it. And I guess through all of that, they're helping countries to measure biodiversity change, work on those reporting obligations that I mentioned, and to inform the policy development. They're trying to really connect national efforts with global systems and integrate biodiversity data with environmental observations. So it's really about helping government, scientists, decision makers to look at the trends, understand the drivers of change, and build out things like predictive models.
Okay. And
the grand plan for all of this is a global biodiversity observation system called GBIOS. So GBIOS is sort of trying to enhance national monitoring schemes, build on data sharing, you know, all the stuff that you and I have seen over our careers, and the collaboration that's needed to meet the biodiversity goals. So they're looking at providing predictive and prioritization guidance for this policy action stuff. So because they've developed the EBV framework, I think that helps to integrate biodiversity data for biodiversity monitoring. And some of the indicators that GeoBond developed are within the monitoring framework of the Kunming-Montreal framework I mentioned, including one of the headline indicators on genetic diversity.
Okay. So from what you've said, it sounds like it's a multi-layered thing with different policy drivers, maybe, guiding different parts of it. And then you've got all the researchers and the scientists and the practitioners as well, all feeding in data and, methods as well, maybe into that. So is it all managed through GeoBond at Secretariat, or are there sort of subsections that manage different bits and then all feed in somehow?
There's a soil bond. So a soil biodiversity observation network, there's a freshwater bond, there's a marine bond. They're doing, the GeoBond is the umbrella, but they're all doing stuff around biodiversity and earth observations. And for me, soil bond is really interesting. I mean, marine bond is always, the marine is always the area that's last to get brought in. That's what I've heard for the last 30 years. And it's probably true, to be fair. But soil bond is really interesting. Because of the biodiversity links, I actually went to Lancaster University and did an introductory course on soil because I knew nothing about it. And right. It kind of blew me away because soil is just so critical. And if you've ever seen Kiss the Ground, the Netflix documentary, it's a brilliant kind of, some of it's a bit too sort of Americanized. I can't say it any other way. Sorry for all my American kids. But it's a bit too OTT. But generally, the way the video is put together is sensational, and it's really informative, and it just shows the power of soil, and it talks about land degradation. And I know you had my buddy Neil Sims on a while ago. So it all comes together, and I think as people are doing a lot more work around agriculture, regenerative agriculture, biodiversity, and all these kind of nature and climate areas are coming together, having experts like SoilBond who fundamentally understand, this layer and what it means is critical. And so it's good to be able to promote their existence.
Yeah, it's amazing how sort of underappreciated soil is. It was only recently that I was reading something, and it mentioned that because we're now regularly or semi-regularly getting land surface temperatures in excess of 50 degrees due to climate change, et cetera, that that obviously has a massive impact on the soil fauna and flora that are there within the soil. And it was one of those things where you think, I should have known this. It's really obvious that if you bake up the soil, then the things that are in it are going to die or move. And yet you need that science. You need someone to tell you, absolutely, this is happening right now, and it's going to get worse the more that the planet heats up and the more we urbanize areas and all of this sort of stuff. So that's great to know that there's these different subsets of GeoBond that's working on all these things.
The other thing I should probably mention, because it's been a pretty massive effort by Geo, is there's also something called the Geo Ecosystems Atlas, which is under development, and that's a resource for mapping and monitoring the world's ecosystems. So it's looking to provide a sort of integrated or harmonized source for that information. And Bond in a Box from GeoBond, it will link to the Atlas so that there's standardized ecosystem information. And then they want to sort of use that to mobilize high quality biodiversity data. So together, the Ecosystems Atlas and Bond in a Box will help those different local and international conservation efforts that I was sort of talking about. And it's good because it's now got, millions of dollars of funding. So it will push ahead quite hard now.
Yeah. So do you know whether or not specific Earth observation sensors are being used preferentially to others, or are there companies that have seen that there's a need for this and are providing data either more cheaply or in large volumes? Or is it a case of, depending on the need locally, then the Earth observation data will get pulled in to deal with that problem locally?
I mean, I know companies that have been doing this for 5 or 6 years. One of my very first clients when I started my own company was Space Intelligence in Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
And they've been doing that. There's another one in Canada I've been working with, Catalyst. They're also, you know, able to do that. And then there's others. You know, there's so many. You have all the civilian, all the public EO missions that are up there. So you have a ton of data coming online from those, some of the existing, and obviously there's a bunch of new ones coming in. There's a big program from ESA called Biospace. And in February next year, there will be hundreds of, you know, biodiversity experts who will be getting together for that as well. So for COS, which is kind of my main job, there is a biodiversity study team, and it's looking at all of these questions that you've kind of raised. So that's a work that will be going on through 2024. And then, you know, the investments made by all of the COS agencies are huge. You know, these are very, very large investments. So it's kind of balancing. I mean, they'll be putting those investments in anyway, because a lot of the work has been done. And, you know, some of the people I work with at NASA also have been working on biodiversity for well over a decade, people like Gary Geller, and then Mark Paganini at ESA. And, you know, there are many, many people in this area. But I think what's interesting is to look at the complementarity of the private funded missions that are going to go up, and the nanosats, the small sats, and others. And I think that's happening quite quick. I mean, there's obviously, you know, Planet has quite a constellation, and they've been very active in this area over the last 2 or 3 years as well. So it'll be interesting to see what else comes online.
Yeah, definitely. So you've mentioned COS a couple of times. Maybe we can smoothly transition from GEO to COS. Both are very important global institutions, probably neither are as well known as they should be amongst the sector and outside the sector. Would you be able to maybe just talk about sort of what some of the similarities are, or what the differences are, what COS is really trying to do compared to maybe GEO?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so GEO, or the Group on Earth Observations, is very complementary to COS, where I now work. COS is not really developing applications or engaging extensively with downstream users. So this is where GEO excels. The GEO members are countries, so various national government agencies, ranging from Departments of Science and Technology to Ministries of Environment and some space agencies. COS is purely space agencies. So, you know, everyone who sits on COS, I shouldn't say purely space agencies. There are 34 space agencies, but there are 30 other organizations under the COS umbrella who work with COS. So you'll have UN agencies in there, but they're working on space. That's maybe a better way to characterize it. But we're also working with other emerging space agencies, you know, so there's countries that have newly created space offices or space research agencies in like Ghana, Kenya, Ethiopia, and other countries. And so we're working with those as well. I sit on the GEO program board, so that helps with the GEO work program, which is going through a massive transformation as GEO enters into its 20th year of existence next year. COS is 40 years old this year. And I'm also the backup to the COS, is something called the SIT chair. So it's a strategic implementation team, which is led by JAXA, the Japanese Space Research Agency. So I'm their backup on the GEO Executive Committee as well. So I'm still quite involved with GEO. COS is providing quite extensive scientific and technical guidance for the civilian EO community, whereas GEO is following more of this, they call it the post-2025 strategy, which is connected to their concept of Earth intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say it's much broader than Earth observation. So they're looking at, greater return on investment, sort of economic and environmental benefits, looking at the areas like, the triple planetary crisis, looking at improving data-driven decision-making, sort of long-term sustainability efforts. But I think they also want to make Earth intelligence accessible across many different decision-making levels and sectors. So really to extend the reach and impact of Earth observation. And so doing that, I mean, GEO has always worked, and so has SEOS, with satellite Earth observation data and on the ground or in situ information. And so now looking more to drive forward how EO data works with other spatial data, social statistics, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, all the areas that we've worked on, but probably formalizing a lot more what's been done. And I guess also driving through the sort of greater equity and inclusion in what's done. And I see that as a sort of a trend coming through a lot of the areas where I'm working is bringing in more gender balance and also more youth engagement.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The youth engagement thing is really interesting because I had a number of conversations recently, all with people of roughly the same age as me. And we're all sort of like, oh, this AI malarkey, it's the end of the world. It's going to be terrible. I'm not sure where this is going. And what I've not done that I would really like to do is have a conversation with someone who's just out of university and see if they're going, actually, this AI thing gets me up to speed in, you know, 20 days or whatever on a specific topic, and I can start looking into things and answering questions rather than spending 3 years trying to learn all the background.
So where I live in Scotland is called Lanarkshire, and I've created this thing called Lanarkshire Entrepreneurs. And so we held the first session last week, and I interviewed a guy who's created he's gone from his garage to which was Hub 1.0 to a gym, which is Hub 2.0, which has like a couple of hundred members. And now he's aiming at Hub 3.0. And that's kind of given me an opportunity to go and engage with a lot of young people, you know, between sort of 16 and 25 where I live. Mm-hmm. And it's like they just see AI as an opportunity. Like they're all just trying to ask me, like, how do we get funds? How do we leverage it? And then I start talking about, you know, what I do and space data, and they're all like, whoa, yeah, we've got to do something here. This is really cool. And it's brilliant because I come from this little village where, you know, I could never have imagined this world that I'm now involved in. And that's kind of why I'm doing the Lanarkshire Entrepreneurs thing, because I'm trying to give others an opportunity to kind of like escape in a way. I mean, they can now just stay in the village and work from home. I mean, you know yourself,
yeah.
We have the technology. But just the fact that they can kind of access someone who's had 3 decades in a high-tech sector and who's done it. And so it's absolutely brilliant to see the energy, the enthusiasm, and the ideas. So I would absolutely encourage you to go and do it. Just go to your local school and say, look, I'm a geezer who does this stuff. Like, I'd love to talk to some of the students about possibilities for, you know, for their career going forward.
Yeah, I may do that because I think it would be a really interesting way of just understanding where the future of the sector could potentially go. I mean, there's so many different ways. So just quickly, with your work on SEOS, like, is that looking at trying to drive trends in the sector, or is it looking at trying to stabilize the way in which things are doing? Is it, so I guess what I'm asking is it more like your entrepreneur type work, or is it more like your OGC type work where you're trying to get standards and things like that?
Yeah, it's kind of a blend. I mean, you've got the world's leading space agencies all coming together, talking across topics from disasters and climate to calibration, validation, and information systems and services. You know, and then there are things called virtual constellations, which are really quite scientific and technical. So, you know, I can be in a meeting 1 week where someone's showing the kind of the code for calibration and validation and the physics and everything, to another meeting where we're talking about capacity development and fundraising and training and other things. So it's really, really broad. But I think the main thing is the kind of the good practice that's coming out. So you'll get a lot of like good practice guidance, you'll get roadmaps, you'll get strategy. And what I found, I mean, I've been involved with SEOS for years, but you know, I was always looking at it from the geo side, and now I'm on the inside. It, the depth and breadth of stuff is quite incredible. And I think the resources that are available are fantastic. And what I'm seeing is more and more private sector engagement. There's something called the System Engineering Office for CEOs, which is led by NASA, by Dave Borges. And through that, there's been a lot more engagement with like the cloud native geospatial endeavors. And so, you know, the stuff on Stack and Cog and Stappy and all these new snappy terms, that investment's coming in, and CEOs is now really starting to get engaged in that. So, you know, all the work on open data cubes and analysis ready data, you know, that a lot of that came through CEOs, through what was Card4L, and a lot of the work from the Australians that then, you know, got taken on by the SEO, and now it's really developed out. So I think it is, I mean, when you're making investments in the billions of dollars, it's pretty good to have a network of peers who are sharing all sorts of good practice guidance and stuff. And I think that can only be good for the sector, you know. As I mean, I was with Aurora Tech in Germany last week, and they were telling me it was brilliant because they went to VH Roda, they met some of the people from the CEOs Working Group on Calibration Validation, and they found that really useful because for them, about to launch a constellation of 8 nanosats, the quality, the data quality, the integration, those issues are absolutely paramount to underpin what they're going to do, to be sort of leaders in wildfire and thermal imaging. Yeah. And so that's really good to hear because it shows that they see the value of what CEOs is doing. And Catalyst, who I mentioned earlier, they recently went through a self-assessment for both optical and SAR data through the CEOs process, and I think Planet's done it as well, and a number of others like SatSure are looking at it. So that I find that it kind of it gives me the warm and fuzzies because you know, I come from the private sector, and so it's great to see greater interaction. I mean, you know, the space agencies themselves are obviously working with the private sector. There's hundreds and hundreds of private companies working with all the space agencies around the world. But, you know, to come into some of the programs and see us explicitly, I think is really encouraging.
Yeah. No, there's so many things we could chat about. It's pinging all sorts of things about data and data quality in my head. But we are going to have to start wrapping up. But before we do so, I just wanted to maybe have a quick chat about what you're doing with Rezo and sort of if you could, I don't know if there's any bits of work that you can maybe give an insight into, the types of people that you're working with, the types of work that you're doing. But also, I know that I realize I'm shoehorning in loads of things here, but you also do a lot in terms of facilitating career progression, and you've sort of alluded to that with what you're doing in Lanarkshire. So if there's anything there as well that you want to sort of just add in, that would be really handy to hear about as well.
Yeah, so most of the work I do outside of CEOs is helping SMEs to work on their business development, comms and market positioning activities. So I mainly work with CEOs or senior leaders of companies between 50 and 100 employees. And about half of those clients have raised millions or tens of millions in a Series A or a Series B round. And they have some big sales numbers to reach for growth and market presence. I also do work for the UN, including the World Bank. I've done some work for GIZ and other international organisations. And again, it's more around technology translation, community or stakeholder comms or engagement things there. I've mentored about 250 younger people, and many of them just happen to be from outside Europe and North America and women. So I could see a number of common themes coming through these discussions. They were things like self-confidence, personal image and branding, networking, you know, needs, and generally just getting ahead in their career. So when I spoke to some of the women who'd put their trust and confidence in me to have these sort of mentoring discussions, I suggested, you know, this Rezo Associates category where I could help amplify their voices. And this is now about 40 women in growing.
Brilliant.
And all I'm really doing is facilitating the development of the network and providing a platform for these individuals to share their ideas and connect with peers. So it means they don't have to quite climb as high on the ladder to be seen or heard.
Yeah.
And what I was thinking is next year in 2025, I may create a charity or a similar organization so we can start to fundraise for the associates. So yeah, I mean, and Letwin Pondo, who's in Zimbabwe, she's just joined me as a coordinator for this group. So it's good, you know, it's nice to be able to help other people. But also going back to your comment about AI, most of them know way more about what's going on than I do. So I'm learning a lot as well. So, you know, I can give them career advice because I've been around the block, but they can also give me input on what's happening and where, you know, where the sort of the movers and shakers and where the technology is going. So it's really nice that, you know, we can learn from each other.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And to have such a large and rich pool of people as well that are all like-minded, all trying to do the same thing. And effectively, as you say, you're creating the opportunity to allow them to sort of build upon themselves, really, amongst that peer group. And then, you know, they will get to where they get to, as it were.
I should also mention there's a network of supporters as well, some okay. really brilliant people who have asked how they can help. And, you know, we've done some calls with some of them talking about their careers. We've had others like highlight funding opportunities and ITTs and various other things. So that side of it's quite important too. You know, it's a kind of a double-edged thing.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. How can people get in touch with you if they want to, if they're interested in this peer group as well?
Well, I mean, they can drop a note on LinkedIn, or if they're still in that archaic, crazy platform that I call Twitter and still called X by others. I'm still on Twitter. I'm sticking it out. I'm not moving to Blue Sky or anything else. I just can't be bothered going through the pain of, you know, learning it, and I'm quite happy. You know, when it dies, I'll just stick on LinkedIn, and, you know, I use Instagram for sort of personal sort of fun and family things. Yeah. So LinkedIn's probably the main one. But if they're still part of the last dying breed on X, they can get me on there. I'm Stephen at Stephen_Ramage.
Brilliant. Stephen, thank you so much for the chat. It's been really fascinating just finding out about all the stuff you've done. And as I've said all the way through, there's probably about another 4 hours worth of content we could record. But that's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And big thanks to the Feldman for getting us to sort this out.
Indeed.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.